Good afternoon, everyone. I'll call the meeting to order. This meeting is held in accordance with House Rule 1001, which is posted online. Our chair, Sunday, experiencing some technical difficulties. So for the time being, as he figures out his audio, I'll be chairing this committee. Mr. Smith, please call the roll to establish a quorum.
Okay, Chair Sundin is present. Vice Chair Vang?
Present.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson present.
Representative Burkle?
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund?
Present.
Representative Hansen R?
Present.
Representative Hansen J?
Present.
Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert?
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick?
Lewick present.
Representative Miller?
Miller present.
Representative Nelson?
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson?
Thompson present.
We have a quorum, Madam Chair.
A quorum is present. Our next item on the agenda is approval of minutes. We have minutes from our informational hearing on aquaculture in October ready for approval. Can I get a motion?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Eklund moved the minutes of the last meeting. Any questions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Seeing no objection, the minutes are adopted. Next, we'll be hearing updates on interim activity from the Minnesota Department of Ag and Board of Animal Health and AURI. Oh, Chair Sundin, I think we can hear you now.
Okay, I'm back. Thank you.
Sounds good.
Okay. Well said, we've got the updates. Jeez, my audio.
Mr. Chair, there seems to be some echo.
Take it away, Vice Chair Fang.
Okay, sounds good. So we'll start our agenda with updates from the Minnesota Department of Ag, Board of Animal Health, and AURI. All of the presentations were sent to members ahead of time and were posted on the committee website. Please use the raise hand button if you want to ask questions when the time comes. So we'll start with the Minnesota Department of Ag, Commissioner Tom Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And hold on a sec here. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and appreciate being able to join you today. We'll just jump right into our PowerPoint, and Kyle has that. So I'll just start out kind of review of in some of the bigger issues we're working on is kind of what we thought we'd highlight today, and then glad to take any questions. Just for a quick reminder or recap, I always think is helpful to think about Minnesota in the grand scheme of things. I always say Minnesota's an agricultural powerhouse from top to bottom. You have 25 million acres in farmland, 67,000 farms. I always say it's interesting to think about what 67,000 farms is, you know, when you look at a population of 5.7 million people. And you look at that, what does it make a farm? What is 67? What do you have to be? And that's $1,000 worth of gross income. So you could sell, you know, a load of hay and a couple of goats a year, and you could be a farmer. So, but the average farm size in Minnesota is 376 acres, and you can see what it supports there. And you're all very familiar with that. Next slide, please. I also think it's always important to see where we rank and some of the top things, just to remind people how we're number one in turkeys, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, and number two in hogs. But it's very, very important. Sugar beets, and then also our big cash crops of soybeans and corn ranking in the top five, which are always very important. But we have very diverse production in the state of Minnesota. So just wanted to always set that as we're thinking about agriculture in Minnesota. Next slide, please. Of course, one of the biggest things we wanted to look at this last year was our drought that we experienced. And many of you participated along with me in looking at this as we kind of got into this in May and June of last year. The drought monitor there is August 17th. I think that was about the worst the drought monitor got for our state. And if you look at that monitor, 90% of the state was in severe conditions, almost 90%. You look at that yellow, covered a lot of the state. The red, which is extreme drought, was 50% of the state. And then that 10% exceptional drought, first time really hitting that in quite a wide swath for a couple of weeks there, and up in Representative Burkle's area, really tough. I'd also say this about the drought monitor that, you know, I think there was some question about whether it was how accurate those are across the state, but they do give you a good idea is what our disasters are set on. I would say like in the Chair Sundin's district or even some of Representative Anderson's district were some of the worst pasture conditions that I saw, or hay conditions, especially in July and early August. So that was, you know, something that was really big on our radar. Thinking back to about what we did as an agency, we quickly stood up a webpage. We started having biweekly meetings that many of you participated in. We connected livestock producers with those selling hay. We didn't do our own hay hotline. We did really promoted a lot of the different ones through Craigslist and Facebook. We did a lot of Wisconsin sites. That seemed to work pretty well. We also provided financial mental health resources that were available to farmers. We opened the disaster recovery loan to farmers. We've had many farmers really purchase feed through that. That's through the RFA. It's a 0% on our share of the loan. And the one other thing I'd say on the drought too, we did was the governor extended three times hours of service waiver for up to a month for moving cattle, livestock, and feed. That was based working with our ag groups and others in that. I will say we're going to talk about the budget next year, but we did put a drought relief package on the table in September. And talking with the governor, I really encourage legislators, if we're going to pass something, to pass it early. If we're going to do what we have put out there on the grants, because really we put it out there in September hoping we would help farmers be able to pay a bill or two. We've seen a lot of cattle lost. Our hay supply is 35% below what we were last year at this time. And last year at this time, we had those third lowest hay stocks that we've had since 1950. So there is concern really from that St. Cloud North area. And if we're going to do something, again, encourage you to do it early in session, because it would take us probably a month to by the time we would get checks out the door. And if we're going to do it at the end of session in May or June, we wouldn't get checks out the door maybe till July or August. And that's just not going to help those farmers. So I just wanted to highlight that. Next slide, Kyle. The big challenges we're looking at facing this year, not a big surprise to a lot of folks here. Input costs have risen substantially. Really, one and two go together. Labor, trucking, infrastructure are very concerned. You probably hear a lot about fertilizer. So we've been meeting with the university and different companies, companies like CHS. The governor has met with CHS, I have, and other companies to see how we're going to do for fertilizer in the spring. Some of the things the state can do is we'll look at hours of service for that too, as we start moving a lot of fertilizer in the spring. But fertilizer is moving into place. It's just expensive as well. I just saw like ammonia is very high, or anhydrous. So that's a concern. Trucking is also something we're looking at as affecting. And of course, labor shortages across ag is just as most sectors. COVID-19 continues to be a challenge among our ag sector. The Omicron hit pretty hard. We kept in close contact with our large food companies. To this point, we have not had major outages. We have had outages at plants, but we're continuing to move along. And then foreign animal disease, you're going to hear too again from Dr. Thompson, but we'll talk about that a little bit too, is that we are concerned watching African swine fever and avian influenza, something Representative Burkle knows quite a bit about and is something the committee should be aware of. Next slide, please. A couple other things that are kind of bigger issues that we the committee asked us to address to today is dicamba. We did have, since the committee met last year, we did, as dicamba is a herbicide, that we did have quite a bit of reports of movement, offsite movement last year. You can see the numbers there. We had 304 reports. We had to move the date back because of the previous administration had changed the way we had our ability in 2020, 2019. We had the June 20th date, and then we had the June 30th date last year. We ended up with a lot of reports. That really led to a lot of work with our staff. We're still working on investigations. So this year we have requested to the EPA an earlier cutoff date of June 12th for south of I-94. You can see that information there, and also a temperature cutoff. Next slide, Kyle. All the registrants, the three registrants have submitted their supplemental label to the EPA for approval. MDA has issued a conditional product registrations with state-specific restrictions. These will take full effect with EPA approval. We are expecting, hopefully, to hear from the EPA in the next month or next week or so, and as they conduct their review. Also, it's important to know that we have training that goes along that, so we are encouraging the EPA to answer us soon on that. And keep in mind, our decision to go with June 12th also came with recommendations from the Minnesota Soybean Growers Drift Task Force and working with the University of Minnesota. But we can really look at our data and see where those drift complaints were and the timeframes that they were in. Next slide, please. We also want to just update you on the groundwater protection rule map. This went into effect in 2019, and we've had two falls with this now, and it's gone relatively well. There's two parts to the rule that affect how farmers spread fertilizer in the fall, or restrict spreading of fertilizer in the fall, and then also work with drinking water supply management areas. Our updated map did add a substantial amount of acres. However, those acres are generally adjacent or close to areas that are previously identified as being vulnerable. We don't anticipate bigger additions like this in the future. We had to update the mapping the way we were doing it. And so this is readily available on our website. Glad to take questions on that too as well. Next slide, please. Then the Pipeline Foods bankruptcy is another piece that some of you may have heard about quite a bit. On July 8th, Pipeline Foods, which is a large organic a company in Minnesota that does organic grain, filed for Chapter 11 under the United States Bankruptcy Court for District of Delaware. It's an active investigation, so we can't comment on a whole lot, but we did have just over 30 claims totaling close to $5.5 million. And just a reminder, the claim period did close on January 4th, and the facility, in accordance with the law, the bond is $500,000. So those are discussions, you know, we'll continue to have. Again, you can see the facility is still navigating bankruptcy with liquidation, and some producers may be entitled to 100% repayment for loads delivered within 20 days of the bankruptcy file. So you can just see that issue too as well. And then last slide. Just want to lead into Dr. Thompson. I really appreciate the partnership we have with the Board of Animal Health. We want to just mention our agency has a strong emergency prepared response. As we've seen in the past years with bovine tuberculosis, avian influenza, as we prepare for African swine fever, the situations we went through 2 years ago with the shutdowns, and you can see the list of things that we do there. And Dr. Thompson will probably talk more about those, but I do want to highlight appreciate the support from the legislature, and preparedness is very important. We have Lucy Hunt, who is our emergency coordinator at the department, who works with farm groups and companies and other agencies to help prepare and make sure that Minnesota is in a good spot to protect all of our livestock. Because these type of things don't just impact big or small producers, it could have the potential to impact all producers. With that, I will try to keep it brief and glad to take any questions about this or anything else.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. Still can't hear your audio. Okay. I will continue to chair this committee. I see hands, Representative Cleveland.
Thank you. This is just a kind of a ground setting question, Commissioner. And so I appreciate the fact that we have 67,500 farms in our state. You know, you and I have had conversations before about my concern of making sure that we get help to the smaller farmers, especially when it comes to the drought relief. And I'm just curious, of those 67,000 farms and the total revenue that goes with those 67,000 farms, can you tell me how much of that is done by like the top 10%? And then how much is, you know, if you've got average farms that are 376, you know, Bill Gates and I walk in a bar together, the average income goes way up, but I don't have any money, right? So I'm just trying to figure out how much of that total revenue is in the top 10%, and then how much is in the remaining 90%?
Madam Chair and Representative Cleveland, you know, I don't have that with me, you know, right handily, but it's something we could provide to you in the committee. We could have our economists look at that. I've seen those numbers, and they do skew. It really depends, because you can break it down by milk or dairy, corn, soybeans. There's, you know, very large. But, you know, in Minnesota, we do have really a lot of more family-sized farms, depending on how you look at that compared to other states. We do have a nice mix of farms. I'll see if I can find something on that. One other thing, I kind of hit the on the drought package too. One of the things we heard was too from our smaller farmers in our drought package. You know, we do look at not just livestock farmers, but also specialty crop farmers who sell at farmers markets, maybe in your district or others. They were hit and don't have that kind of crop insurance and backstop that our corn and soybean farmers do. And again, I don't want to say that they are made whole by it, but some of those farmers too were. You know, there were certain crops they just didn't grow. Livestock farmers lost a couple of hay crops. They might have lost like their melon crop and other things like that. And so we are trying to address all of that and looking at that. And then I also want to remind the committee that, you know, you funded an emerging farmers coordinator at the department, and we did hire that person. And we are still continuing to work with our working group on looking at those issues. But we can look at that and see what I can find out.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, so if you're putting together a report, maybe a few or just some general information for us. So of those 67,000 farms, you know, maybe if you could let us know what the top 10% is and in each of those categories, and also how much of the revenue is captured by those top 10%. I think that would be helpful. And then of the farming acres that we have, how many of those farming acres are done by the top 10%? I think that would be just kind of ground setting information for our committee as we're making these really difficult choices about where we can spend our dollars. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Nope, we'll see what we can do. Yep.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Commissioner. Question, a couple of questions. First of all, you added about 850,000 acres to the nitrogen protection criteria. That's a lot of acres. What changed in your selection process? And I did talk to a couple of folks down at the ag meeting in Mankato, and they had the acres added but weren't notified. Were the folks who were affected by this notified when all these acres were added to the nitrogen watch list?
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. Yes, and thank you. Those are 250,000 acres, again, spread out across the state. That is cropland, and the other is non-cropland areas. So that were added. So the 600,000 is non-cropland, but it is, quite a bit added, and it had to do with a mapping system that we had originally used that we improved or updated, or the contractor we were using. So we do feel that it was the right thing to do. We wished it could have been done the first time to show those acres that were put in. We are notifying, or we do work through different pieces to notify those farmers. And I don't know if there's another staff person that could comment on that or how we notify. I don't know if it's Josh or Roger would want to comment on how we people find out. The maps are on our list. We also have that as part of the rule that we updated on January 15th every year. And that was actually a comment that I had worked on before I was commissioner, so that people knew or had an idea of where those updates were. So there's different ways they find out, but I don't know if another staff person wants to comment on that. Let me see.
Well, Commissioner, I can take a shot at responding. For the record, my name is Dan Studdard. I'm Assistant Director for Environmental Programs in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Division. So the primary way that we notify people, the map is actually updated by rule by January 15th each year for fall application restrictions that take effect in September. So as Commissioner Peterson mentioned, some of the comments that we got when we were developing the rule is that we wanted to provide as much notice as we could on these changes. And so the primary means for communicating with this is through press releases. We do emails through ag groups. We try to kind of blanket the ag community in Minnesota to let them know that this is going on. And in particular, it really hit that hard as fall is approaching. But we did send out a bunch of emails and a press release as soon as the map is updated. And then for individuals who are in a drinking water supply management area, which is affected, we really try to establish a relationship with each one. So we have mail outs to individuals, and then we communicate through them and through retailers and folks who are in the duisms that are affected.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I guess back to you. Would you anticipate this to be kind of an annual? You say you update it every year. Would you anticipate additional acres being added in this number, this size, or is this kind of a one-time catch-up addition to the acreage?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that's a good way to put it. I do not anticipate further adjustments to this size or in the future. I think that if they're looking at it and everything, there will be corrections every year, but they would not be to this size.
Okay.
All right. Last follow-up, Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thanks again, Madam Chair. I'll try to make this really quick, more of a comment. Commissioner, you're working on the dicamba thing, and I realize that's it's a touchy subject. It's difficult. You have a lot of work going into checking the complaints. But I would just add that there's another situation coming up with soybean folks that the EPA has banned another chemical called Enlist Duo in six counties in the state. South Dakota has had seven counties where two products were banned by a new classification concerning an endangered species. So down the road, it's going to be difficult for soybean farmers to work with the herbicides to control their weeds. And what do you see happening down the road with that, Commissioner?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, thanks too for, again, you know, dicamba is it's a tough issue, you know, and I think that it's, you know, I want to be clear that we, you know, do see a value in it. It does work extremely well. But the dates and the steps we're taking, I think will help farmers keep it for a longer time. The Enlist Duo decision by the EPA also will complicate that further. And so what we're doing is too working with our staff and the EPA our staff in the University of Minnesota and also crop consultants to really try to get out the message what is going to be available in the future. And it is, you are correct, that is something that, including for, I think your county is one of those counties. So as we look at what's going to be available, we don't have the answers right today, but it's something that we acknowledge and are trying to stay on top of as much as we can. And, you know, and I just want to say again on the dicamba, the, you know, the registrants are all working with us, and I really do appreciate the work the companies have done with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you, Commissioner. You know, we're entering year three of this pandemic, and you highlighted some of the challenges that are there. And, you know, what's happened in many businesses and many forms, and even what we're doing right now, we're virtual. We've had to change the way we operate. And it always seems like the what happens with agriculture is that we have to adapt to the practices rather than the practices adapting to the times and changing. And, you know, one of the things I learned way back in my soils courses when I was younger was there's a difference between production and profitability. That going for maximum production with using the inputs, nobody is requiring people to use maximum amount of fertilizer. Nobody's requiring anybody to use dicamba. Nobody's requiring that. It's the perception of the market that you have to have that production and profitability. And profitability in agriculture for at least the last 5 years has been significantly supplemented from the federal government. And now there are some proposals for significant supplementing at the state government. And so, you know, managing things differently than what we've done is what businesses have had to do. And some businesses, many businesses in all of our districts have folded, and others have had to adapt. And I'm concerned that we continue to go back to, we need to adapt to the practices and make them work rather than the practices or the production or the profitability adapt to the times. And we have a very different agriculture that we did even 50 years ago. I'm not proposing going back to that. But we've lost the diversification, both in people and in types of farms. We've had more consolidation. And how do we, to go off of what Representative Cleborn was saying, how do you actually serve as a catalyst for rebuilding a diversified agriculture and diversified communities? How do we do that when the pressure from the stakeholders and the interest is always adapt to the status quo and give us some more money? Because that's what I hear. Adapt to, we need to do what we keep doing and give us some more money because we're not making it. And I don't know how long we can sustain this status quo. I don't think my constituents, if they're watching their businesses close or their schools having to adapt. We have 5.7 million people in the state, and we're supposed to work for all of them. And that would require adjusting how we do things. And I know the pressure is there to keep the status quo. I know that nostalgia is a powerful thing. I know that change is really hard. But at some point, there's some responsibility that both we as the appropriators of money, but also the people who are asking for the money have to take in terms of how do we make changes to be productive and profitable and vibrant in the future. That's kind of a long rant. Commissioner, you know I usually do those, but it just, I'm concerned about just writing the check without change.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, boy, there's a lot there, you know, and, you know, I just, you know, it's something I think about all the time. I look at, like, you know, agriculture in Minnesota is so diverse and yet so, and I do say diverse because when you look at our crops and our livestock, we intersect about halfway on both, you know, our cash receipts on crops or livestock can really vary. And I look at where are the positives and where are things that farmers are doing. And it can be real hard, even as commissioners sometimes, to look at where are the positives. And, you know, and I think you get into what do we need to do with our agriculture? Who do we need to feed? You know, and, I always said I wasn't a feed the world type of person until I became a commissioner and actually get to go on some of the trade missions and visit with people. And you realize that some parts of the world, they don't have enough food, you know, and so we need to produce that for them. And how do we help produce that and help our economy in a sustainable way? And so I think that I am excited about a lot of the things I am starting to see from the very smaller farmers to the bigger farmers. You can look at our Ag Water Quality Certification Program, I think, as a real shining star that's really starting to take off. You look at over 1,000 farmers, 800,000 acres in just a short amount of time. But I look at the practices that those farmers are changing. As I visited farms all around the state, that we are starting to see, a nice adoption where it makes sense of cover crops, of rotations, of different types of tillage systems, and not just even within our own program, that these make sense. And so we have to keep looking at that. We produce a lot of corn, you know, 24 million acres in the state, 9 million acres of corn. Even if we replace the wheat acres in the state, that's 1 million acres. You know, we're going to grow corn for a while. So we have to figure out ways to keep improving. The corn growers themselves have, contests where they have give innovation grants to farmers. It's really an interesting thing. So I'm encouraged, you know, and I get what you're saying, and believe me, it's something that I take to heart, and, you know, we have to continue to look at that, because I think you're right. The consumers are going to start voting with their dollar, and I just really, I appreciate the comments, and something we'll keep working on.
I see one more question from Representative Eklund, and then we'll move on to Board of Animal Health, and if members have more questions for Commissioner Peterson, we can ask those towards the end of the presentations. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably the pretty perfect lead in since Board of Animal Health is coming up next. But Commissioner, I appreciated how you emphasized your swine flu preparedness and other preparedness that you're working with in our meat producers. And I appreciate that. Can you tell me what level of importance or where you're at on CWD prevention and preparedness in the Department of Agriculture?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Eklund, and thank you. I think CWD is something that we spend a lot of time on. You know, the Department of Agriculture doesn't have a direct role in regulating deer farms, as you're going to hear, and you're familiar with the Board of Animal Health, and the DNR manages the wild herd. But, you know, we do advocate and look at all types of agriculture, and we have, I look at the Department of Ag's role in it as trying to, you know, help figure out the situation that we're in with chronic wasting disease, a very serious situation as we look at the farms that we have in the state, and we look at what our role at the Department of Agriculture is trying to, you know, understand the importance of deer farming in the state, but also the importance of the wild deer herd, but also the importance of the wild deer herd as on the rest of the farms in the state of Minnesota. I mean, visiting with legislators this morning from southeast Minnesota and you look at the impact that deer can have on crops and other things. And so there's a lot to this whole issue. So I see as we're trying to understand and figure out how do we, you know, I'm personally not one that says we're going to eradicate CWD, but how do we contain it like we do other pests, and how do we mitigate and control as much as we can. So I try to work with both the board and the DNR. I think ag's in a unique position where we can work with both to really advance the cause of not eradicating CWD. It'd be great if we could, but I think we have to be honest that the best thing we can do is control it. And we have, you know, situations and things that I think work, but it is very complex. So that's my role, is I could sit it out and everything, but I do try to get in there and try to work and try to figure out how do we balance between those two. And I think it's a struggle sometimes, but to be honest, but you know, I think we just have to continue to work on it. And I see a lot of solutions hopefully coming forward as we move forward.
Follow up, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, next we'll move on to Board of Animal Health. We have Dr. Beth Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to check, you can hear me okay?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Beth Thompson, for the record. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and also the State Veterinarian. I appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to present an overview of the board and our busy year. Next slide, please. There we go. As a reminder to the members and the folks that are listening in, the Board of Animal Health is comprised of 6 members appointed by the governor. The role of this agency in Minnesota is to protect the health of the domestic animals. As part of our mission, disease detection, prevention, control, elimination all rise to the top of our priority list, especially when we're talking about foreign and transboundary diseases, but also endemic diseases. And I'm going to talk a bit more about all of those in a few minutes here in the next slides. And the next slide, please, I'm going to start out with rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus type 2. So RHDV2 is classified as a foreign animal disease in the U.S., and there have been many outbreaks since 2019. To be clear, this virus does not impact human health. However, this disease affects both domestic and wild rabbits, and many times the only sign of the disease is sudden death and, you know, a bloodstained nose. The virus is resistant to extreme temperatures and can be easily spread rabbit to rabbit. So in Minnesota, we did have one case of this foreign animal disease late in September of 2021 in Ramsey County with the death of 2 pet rabbits. Next slide, please. A press release on this was issued on September 28th. That release alerted both the public and, importantly, the veterinarian community of the finding. I recommend anybody who knows a rabbit or bunny owner to check out our online information. If you go to our website and search for the word rabbit, you will find a page dedicated to this disease, biosecurity for owners, best practices for humans, housing, guidelines, what's recommended when you're returning from a fair or a show, feeding and other rabbit health recommendations. We recommend that all bunny owners have a veterinarian. That client-patient relationship is very important when you're talking about all species of animals. Next slide, please. After the finding of this disease, this virus in Minnesota, we approved a vaccine for use within days. And I just want to take a moment to highlight the work of some of the folks on this event. If you visit the Miracle of Birth Center at the State Fair, the bunnies that are on display there come from Peace Bunny Island. And this is a nonprofit where rabbits are trained to be comfort animals. And there's also a wide range of educational events revolving around the care and well-being of rabbits. This organization, along with a handful of veterinarians, set up vaccine clinics for rabbits. And I was, quite honestly, I was amazed and humbled by the way these folks were able to get large numbers of rabbits vaccinated with COVID protocols in place. There were vaccine clinics held in the Twin Cities in Rochester, some in some other cities. And we even had some calls from Wisconsin rabbit owners asking if they could bring their rabbits into Minnesota to get the vaccination. So the board hopes to continue this relationship, especially with Peace Bunny Island and some of those veterinarians that helped us into the next fair season, as there's always more work to be done. Next slide, please. Moving on to African swine fever, this is a foreign animal disease that we have followed for years. The last time this foreign animal disease was in our hemisphere was in the 1980s. ASF is a very hardy virus. It can be stable and resistant in low temperatures and actually needs to be heated to something like 135 degrees Fahrenheit for 70 minutes to be inactivated. The virus lives for a long time in blood, in feces, and in uncooked or undercooked pork products. This virus has never been detected in the United States, and it is not a food safety concern. However, the slide is showing the extent of this disease in Europe. We also know the disease decimated the hog herd in China in 2019, and that country and region continues to deal with the virus. ASF can be transmitted directly pig to pig. It can be transmitted indirectly via contaminated feed and fomites, and the virus can be carried by certain ticks. This virus is extremely contagious, and the amount of virus an infected pig sheds is very high. Next slide, please. Within the last year, this foreign animal disease has been diagnosed in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti. The last time the disease was in our hemisphere, as I mentioned, it was located in the Caribbean too. With the short distance between both the mainland and also Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, continues to work with the Dominican Republic and to some extent with Haiti on disease control. However, this is not an easy task, and state animal health officials continue to prepare for an incursion onto the mainland US. Now, Minnesota is very fortunate because we do not have an established population of feral swine. In approximately 2010, the board worked together with the Department of Natural Resources and also USDA Wildlife Services to put a feral swine plan in place, and the three agencies continue to respond quickly to any reports of loose swine in the state. However, the ability of this virus to maintain infectivity in feed, to be carried on boots, to travel with people, means that we need to continue to plan for a response. Next slide. One of the areas that we pay close attention to is the possible importation of ASF through our airports and travelers, as I mentioned. So all food waste that comes off planes into Minneapolis St. Paul Airport is incinerated and has been for a number of years. Minneapolis St. Paul Airport is also the site for trained canines and actually is known for the excellent work that those dogs are doing in that airport. Next slide. And importantly, the board hosts and coordinates an emergency disease management committee for swine. The list of the subcommittees is up on the screen there. Participants in these subcommittees include other agencies, the University of Minnesota, Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, veterinarians, farmers, other states, and Commissioner Peterson mentioned Lucy Hunt, the Emergency Response Division at Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Everybody is part of this response planning. So I'm going to talk in just a moment about avian influenza, and you all may remember the Minnesota response in 2015. So a response to African swine fever would look very similar. We would stand up an incident command team, request USDA assistance, implement control areas around infected farms, depopulate infected animals, and work quickly and effectively to eliminate the virus on those farms to get them back in business. It is a stamping out that needs to be done. We have agreements in place with USDA for many diseases and rely on them for such things as coordination of federal response, communication with international trading partners, and we also look to the National Animal Health Laboratory System, or NALM, for validation and approval of tests for foreign animal diseases. It's an ongoing coordinated effort between states and the national government. And please remember, I believe Commissioner Peterson showed this too, that Minnesota is number two in hog production in the US. Next slide. Moving on into highly pathogenic avian influenza, HIPAH H5 is currently being found. Oh, excuse me, I missed a slide there. Low-path avian influenza. When there are suspect cases of influenza in poultry, either based on routine surveillance or testing sick birds, all of that must be reported to the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. And as a reminder, low-path does not cause significant sickness in poultry. It's also endemic in the wild waterfowl population. So finding low-path avian influenza is not uncommon here in the state of Minnesota. Now in the next slide, I jumped ahead to my HIPAH. HIPAH avian influenza, H5, is currently being found in both wild and domestic birds across several continents. And this is a very concerning situation. So in a report dated January 17th of 2022, the World Organization for Animal Health reported that, and this is a direct quote, the current HIPAH avian influenza season continues with a high number of outbreaks in poultry and non-poultry in Europe, a few countries in Africa, and also Asia. The recent detection of H5N1 in Canada is the first identification of the H5 virus, the Guangdong lineage, in the Americas since June of 2015. Based on this known pattern, further increase in highly pathogenic avian influenza spread is expected in several regions in the coming months. So before we go on to the next slide, members, just pay attention to the red and green dots in Europe. And then if we go to the next slide, let's look at those flyways. So the flyway over Eastern Europe, and this is the wild waterfowl flyway, overlaps with the flyway over the US Atlantic coast, which then overlaps with the Mississippi flyway. So depending on the season and depending on the flyway, wild birds are moving north to south, south to north. They don't stay in their lanes. And notice that the East Atlantic flyway spans the ocean. So the ocean barrier has now been breached. As I mentioned, we've found highly pathogenic avian influenza in a backyard flock, a couple of them up in Canada. So we are not really in a situation of if, but I would argue we're in a situation of when we will see highly pathogenic avian influenza in the United States again. Next slide, please. Specifically to those findings here in North America, in late December of 21, there was a highly pathogenic avian influenza finding in a flock in eastern Canada. This was followed by a report at a second nearby farm in mid-January of 22, and actually there's been another finding now in the last couple of days. Canada does follow the same protocols as the U.S. for dealing with foreign animal diseases. That first flock, to give you an idea, there were a total of approximately 420 birds on site. 360 of those died. Next slide, please. Highly pathogenic avian influenza. Hunter-harvested wild birds have been diagnosed here in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia just in the last week. The first announcement from some of those findings came in the middle of January. So as I've mentioned to you in the past, state animal health officials and animal health and ag agencies in the U.S. are in constant communication on foreign animal and transboundary disease issues. This is not expected, as wild waterfowl can be infected and carry high path avian influenza without signs of illness. So when wild birds migrate, the virus migrates with them. Next slide, please. So the need for our poultry owners, our backyard flock owners, anyone who cares for poultry in the state of Minnesota, they need to be practicing good biosecurity. They need to increase surveillance as needed and also report sick birds. So this is just crucial during this upcoming spring wild bird migratory season. The board continues to conduct routine surveillance in collaboration with poultry owners and veterinarians. I also know that USDA Wildlife Services here in Minnesota will be assisting in surveillance activities for wild waterfowl, but we don't need to ring that bell of finding it in wild waterfowl here in the state. Every poultry owner or caretaker needs to be on top of biosecurity now. And then a last comment, we do also have an emergency disease management committee for poultry, and that met this last Friday, again, to discuss highly pathogenic avian influenza and the need for surveillance and biosecurity. Next slide, please. Moving into the Farm Survey Program, Minnesota currently has approximately 233 registered herds. White-tailed deer herds account for 149 of that total number. Elk have 82 of the total number. And then when we pulled the data for this slide, the total number of head in Minnesota was 7,000, just over 7,000. As always, members, if you want more details on any of this information, please let us know. So just briefly to compare to some of our neighbors, Wisconsin reports 301 registered white-tailed deer prems in their state. South Dakota has 23 farm surveyed herds. And if you travel over to Pennsylvania, this is interesting. They have over 750 breeding farms, hunt farms, and hobby farms. Next slide, please. Speaking only to the white-tailed deer portion of the survey program, the board and DNR have been working concurrently based on the changes made to statute 35.155. This slide outlines some of the concurrent work being done by the two agencies. In addition to that, members, you should have received a link or a copy of the report that was submitted yesterday by the two agencies. Again, if anybody needs a copy or a link, please let me know. Just on a very high level, in the field, the DNR staff accompanied board staff on 50 inspections on white-tailed deer farms as mandated by the 2021 legislative change. We are also working on a number of other areas. For example, the board uses a database for all species, which allows us at a very minimum to track premises, owners, contact information, official identification, test results, and other data. We have now stood up a database between the two agencies and are awaiting DNR staff assignments so that we can concurrently input and track white-tailed deer within this database. Next slide, please. This schematic, and again, please let me know if you would like, I believe you have a copy of this, but if you need more information, describes the Beltrami County herd investigation. As you may recall, this herd tested positive for chronic wasting disease and was depopulated in May of 21. This herd received animals from three herds, counties of Winona, Hennepin, and Kennebec. When there was a CWD positive or exposed animals, generally, the United States Department of Agriculture becomes involved in the process so that the agency has the ability to provide indemnity for the depopulated animals. USDA also assists in depopulation via their wildlife services and provides other support for the depopulation. Again, this slide has a lot of detail on it, and if there are specific questions, I believe we can go back to it, Madam Chair. Otherwise, next slide, please. The board has continued to provide updates and communications along with other agencies involved in the Beltrami response. The owner of the Beltrami White-tailed Deer Farm is now part of a lawsuit The state is alleging that the owner broke quarantine and caused the dumping of deer carcasses on state land prior to the herd being depopulated. More specifically, the board is the lead agency on the mandatory cleanup of the farm as we work together with USDA on those protocols. We are also the lead state agency on the land access agreement for the carcass dump site, and also the lead state agency on the lawsuit which names the former white-tailed deer owner as defendant. That lawsuit is ongoing. Next slide, please. Members, I believe you are aware of this, but on October 11th, 2021, the DNR enacted an emergency order banning the importation of white-tailed deer, along with the intrastate or within-state movement of white-tailed deer. This action was based on the finding of CWD in a Wisconsin herd that had sent a number of animals into a number of states. Minnesota received 5 of those animals, and the board had determined the location of those animals, whether dead or alive. The ban was then lifted on December 6th. Next slide, please. I believe this is my last slide, members. The board had filed its initial request for comments on farm survey rulemaking back in June of 2020. We have been working on a timeline that allowed new and updated rules for, I'm talking about the complete farm survey program now. We wanted to move forward with that, preferably with a hearing date over at the Office of Administrative Hearings sometime in early 2022. We have since paused the rulemaking with the implementation of concurrent authority for white-tailed deer. It has been and it continues to be the board's intention to work together concurrently with the DNR on rules for the white-tailed deer species. And as I mentioned, next slide, please. Yes, I believe I'm done, Madam Chair. Thank you. And if there are any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Thompson. I was interested in some of the terminology you were using with African swine fever and IPATH avian influenza and preparedness. And, you know, we've had similar presentations over the years, but, you know, there was a published study a couple of weeks ago from Iowa where deer had COVID. And it was quite endemic in both the wild and the domestic herd in Iowa, which is next door to us. And we know that COVID kills. So, you know, of all the diseases you've talked about today, the one that we know kills people is COVID, and that we have testing available for people. So I'd like to know what's happening with testing the captive cervids for COVID, because if we have such a large reservoir of the potential for mutation, either on the farm or in the field with deer, we have a huge problem in front of us where this disease that has vexed us for almost 3 years could mutate again and again and again in that reservoir of animal. So I'd like to know what the plan is for testing captive cervids for COVID.
Members, I want to make sure that we have enough time for our next testifiers as well. And so please keep your questions concise. And I'll just allow for one question, considering the timelines that we're in. Dr. Thompson.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Chair Hansen, thank you for that. That is a very timely question. And University of Minnesota researchers are also looking at the amount of COVID here in Minnesota, working together with both the Board of Animal Health and Department of Natural Resources. The one thing to note about COVID in deer, we don't seem to see deer picking up COVID and then passing it back to humans. That would be very concerning, very concerning. If you look at the data out now from China and hamsters. Oh, everybody thought that maybe that situation was getting a little blown out of proportion, but in fact, we are seeing that hamsters, at least in that situation that happened recently in China, not only got COVID from humans, but then gave it back. So if there's more detail you'd like to know about the University of Minnesota research, there's also other states that are looking at COVID in deer, I'd be happy to provide that to you, Chair Hansen. Thank you for the question.
My apologies, I'm at one question per member. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Thompson, it's good to see you again. I'm impressed with the work that the Board of Animal Health is doing on containing, preparing to contain, doing what they can with all these diseases and such that you talked about. And one of the things I was struck with the feral swine flu issue. What I'm concerned is, I appreciate the Board of Animal Health is doing that work, but we don't have an established herd of feral swine in the state. And it seems like more emphasis is put on that than containing and curtailing chronic wasting disease. So I was just curious if you'd comment on that, Dr. Thompson. And then one other thing, the report I thought was kind of weak. I'm certainly hoping that we can put more decent backbone into it as we move forward.
Dr. Thompson?
Madam Chair and Representative Eklund, thank you for those comments. And just to be clear, African swine fever affects both wild or feral hogs and also commercial hogs. So the fact that we don't have feral swine in Minnesota is a big plus for Minnesota. That's a number of state and federal agencies working together to make sure that we don't have that possible route of contamination that would then shed the disease into our commercial, our backyard, our 4-H pigs. So my point was, not unlike Texas, unlike Louisiana, unlike the southern tier of the United States, we don't have to worry about feral swine. Thank you for the question.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here, Dr. Thompson. I'll be quick. I just wanted to commend the Board of Animal Health on their efforts to contain and prevent what we could see coming here. I've lived it myself in 2015, and I know for a fact, I just finished my own personal biosecurity plan with the Board of Animal Health back in December, and I know they're ahead of the curve on this. But one question for Dr. Thompson, I've heard rumor, or maybe it's not, maybe it's true, but beyond the North Carolina and South Carolina infections, is there a case in Virginia now as well? I thought I heard that somewhere.
Dr. Thompson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Burkle, I may have been speaking too quickly. There is, within the last week, hunter harvested samples taken from Virginia have also come up with the H5 high path virus.
Okay, nothing further. I just hope that we all understand that these flyways, as she showed in the slides, the way these flyways work, and my concern is that, you know, as we get into the spring and this Mississippi flyway, the birds coming back, the wild birds coming back, we got an issue there. And I know you guys are ahead of it. You were diligent working through my biosecurity plan. I've heard from other growers that said the same thing. So I know you're on it, but thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next we have on our agenda is AURI. We have Mr. Dan Skogan, and then Federico, Tripodi, and Shannon Sledge. Mr. Skogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Dan Skogan. I'm Director of Government and Industry Relations for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, or AURI. It's always a pleasure to come before this committee to talk about the work that AURI is involved with. Now, today I've brought with me two testifiers. You'll be hearing from Shannon Schleck, the Executive Director at AURI. But to get us started today, Madam Chair, I would like to turn things over to our Chairman of the AURI Board of Directors, Federico Tripodi. Federico has served as a public company executive with extensive experience in agricultural, food, and health R&D and product development. During his 20-year career in the ag, tech, and seed industry, he has led organizations in both Fortune 500 and entrepreneurial settings. Federico adds a very unique skill set to our board of directors and serves on the AURI board as an at-large position. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll direct you to direct Federico to present his testimony.
Federico?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to represent AURI today. My name again is Federico Tripodi. I have been a board member at AURI for 3 years. I was just recently elected to serve as the chairman of the chair of the board at AURI. And before that, I served as the secretary and treasurer. My family and I have called the Midwest and the Midwest agriculture home for the last 20 years. And the last six of those we've called Minnesota home. I am currently a business owner and an investor working in the agricultural technology and food space. And if we could go to the next slide, please. AURI's mission is to foster the long-term economic benefit for Minnesota through value-added agricultural products. We aim to increase our state's competitiveness through value-added agriculturally derived products and services. And we accomplish this by leveraging our broad infrastructure across the state and talent to connect technologies, supply chains, needs, and opportunities in a way that will provide impact for our local economies. Our breadth, as you see on these slides, is as diverse as our state's agricultural ecosystem, yet always focused in our clear mission and mandate. On our board, we have the strength of bringing together directors from the legislature, producer organizations, industry, and small businesses. And our role at the board for AURI is twofold. One is to provide our diverse experiences and industry networks and organizational networks to provide strategic insight on a really rapidly evolving landscape in our industry. And the other one is to provide sound governance and financial oversight for the organization. If we could go to the next slide, please. Our projects touch almost every corner and county of our state through business services. And we also conduct initiatives and outreach events that have grown over the last few years, in some instances, bringing national and international attention to our state. Shannon, our executive director, Madam Chair, will walk us through the rest of the slides and the really exciting results we've shown for the organization and the state in the last year. Thank you.
Shannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here with you today and reflect upon the past year, as well as share some of the impacts of the projects that we've been working on. As Federico mentioned, it's been busy as you look at the map of the activities. And here's just a quick at a glance of some of the activities that occurred during fiscal year 21. Opening over 100 new projects, servicing over 200, closing 75 of them, and really just keeping active across all of our focus areas. As we look at this, a large number of food projects, but also a large number of multi-area projects, which cover multiple focus areas, and some bigger projects in our co-products and bio-based renewable energy space. We also greatly expanded our outreach efforts, or our convening, over this past year, conducting 31 events and over almost 2,600 participants at those events, a big increase from the previous year. And you can see here as well, we had from our fiscal year at a glance, $5.1 million in revenue, $4.7 million in expenses. That large difference is mainly due to our PPP loan forgiveness that we recognized during this fiscal year. I'll be very quick on just some of the focus area work that we've been conducting. In our food area, it's a very robust part of our entrepreneurial ecosystem. And we had a large number of projects, opened 51 projects, worked on over 100. And this is working mainly with a diverse set of clients, from producers to small entrepreneurs to larger businesses as well, in terms of providing assistance and input into their products. That ranges from shelf life to nutrition facts labels to packaging support and helping them source products as well. A few of the companies that we worked with on the side over there during this past year. Our cool products area is an area that we've seen a lot of growth lately as companies look at circular approaches and sustainable approaches. And we do a lot of work on dewatering, drying, and densification, or ways that we can make waste streams more economical and put them into use into feeds, fertilizers, fuels, and even food in some cases as we upcycle that material and help add a new value stream to those businesses. And renewable energy, these are support that we continue to give to the ethanol and biodiesel industry, as well as we've done a lot of looking forward on renewable energy in the past year. Anaerobic digestion is one area that we've put a lot more emphasis and focus on in terms of looking at opportunities for the state. And the other area would be hydrogen. And we're a founding member of the Hydrogen Economy Collaborative, which has been meeting now for several months in terms of looking at hydrogen opportunities for the state, and ARI looking specifically at agricultural opportunities that may be of value as we think about a hydrogen economy. We also continue to conduct our renewable energy roundtable. Last year's renewable energy roundtable is on biofuels resilience, and we've also done one recently on biomass for hydrocarbon use in fuels as well. Biobase is an area that has a lot of opportunity as we continue to look forward. We've done everything from life cycle assessments in that area for road sealants that we've talked about in the past, to new packaging opportunities using starch products from our crops that are grown here, to things like hempcrete, and just looking at what are ways that we can utilize the crops and alternative uses here. And that, as I said, continues to be a growing area for us, and I think a lot of opportunity. I'll speak to just a few of the bigger initiatives that we've conducted over the past year. I mentioned the road sealant feasibility with the city of Hutchinson. That showed that using soil-based preservations can add 3.5 to 11 years of road life to those city streets. We conducted a Minnesota aquaculture report that was really looking forward at the opportunities for aquaculture in our state, some recommendations and what are some opportunities and areas that we need to come together to help move that opportunity forward. We had a digital and e-commerce guide available for food entrepreneurs and other entrepreneurs with the big shift that we saw to e-commerce from the pandemic, and just helping prepare those businesses for that transition. FODMAP, an ATI weed project that we conducted with the U of M, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture sponsored that project, Minnesota Wheat and Backwind Foods. And that was really looking at our wheat varieties in terms of digestibility issues that we've seen with wheat. And are there some opportunities or ways that we can look forward for our wheat producers to find some new market opportunities? Co-manufacturing is something that industry has raised with us in terms of finding the right size processing facilities. Appears to be a large opportunity from the research in terms of investment into that area. 5% return could provide a very large benefit to the state in terms of economic activity as well as job creation. And then our stakeholder analysis that we do every year to look for collaborative projects as well. I do want to speak briefly on the meat and livestock initiative work that we've been doing. Thank you for the support last year and providing funding for meat scientists. We have been able to move forward and hire a new meat scientist, Clay Newton, in our Marshall facility. He started in December. And with our work in the meat science area, we were also able to obtain a 2-year agreement with USDA to support local and regional meat processing. And that's allowed us to bring on another meat scientist, so Laura Bachmeyer, who will be based in the Alexandria area, and working on advancing initiatives and supporting our local and regional meat industry in Minnesota and with the USDA program across the 5-state region here as well. We were also able to award the grant funding that the legislature provided last year for a mobile meat slaughter. We conducted a request for proposal and a selected Farmers Union Foundation as a recipient for that grant in moving forward with a mobile meat slaughter unit for the state for processing and for educational purposes. Our initiatives, as we look at our ARI Connects, I mentioned that it's growing substantially. We conduct, I'd say, 5 key areas. One is a thought leader group to bring together stakeholders and industry to talk about areas of opportunity and challenges and explore possible solutions. We also do 2 ongoing Connects activities, one being Fields of Innovation, looking for niche opportunities or new crop opportunities. A webinar Wednesday, which is more of a general education opportunity around what's going on in the innovation ecosystem and our agricultural industry. And then our big events are the Renewable Energy Roundtable that I mentioned previously, and our Bold Open platform, which is an open innovation platform looking for solutions for innovation problems faced by Minnesota companies and entities. So we've been doing that program for the last 3 years as well, and it's grown substantially into providing new opportunities. This last year, we were fortunate to be able to add some new resources for our technical work as well. We've added an oilseed press, which continues to receive a lot of attention, a dehuller, and also added a portable anaerobic digester system in Waseca to add to that work and get some good data on scale of opportunities. As we look forward for the organization, a few things that we've identified in terms of needs for ARI to continue meeting its mission and adding value to the Minnesota agricultural industry. We would like to look forward to a cost of living adjustment, really advancing our anaerobic digester work and finding some new opportunities for the state in that area. Life cycle analysis is a question that we get routinely and we don't have the expertise. Our facilities in Crookston and Waseca, and then just equipment upgrades to stay current with some of the innovation needs that we're seeing, especially in the protein space. Just to close here, I'm always very proud of the work that the ARI team does on a yearly basis. We work hard on the applied research and advancing ideas into the commercial space. Over the last fiscal year, we helped create nearly 600 jobs, create or retain, $118 million in new capital investment, and over $320 million in new sales that were reported back to us from our client activity over the past year. So a great return in my mind on the investment that the state makes, and we appreciate your collaboration and support to continue advancing these ideas from Minnesota entrepreneurs and farmers and across our ecosystem into commercial realities. So I'll just close that it's a great state for ag innovation. This is just a map of all the clients that ARI has serviced since its beginning years in 1989. And we, again, continue to appreciate the support and what you do to help us turn these ideas that we see across the state into reality. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Lipper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Schlecht. I have a question about the portable anaerobic digester. I'm just curious if you could say more about how you're using that, then also the opportunities that you see for anaerobic digestion going forward.
Is there such?
Very good, Madam Chair, Representative Lippert. Yeah, we obtained this anaerobic digester through a program with the University of Florida and Xcel Energy. And it contains two 1,200 gallon tanks that we can use. So it's a good size from benchtop, right? This is a 53 foot semi that we have at our Waseca facility. So we've been able to use that to look at feedstocks from about five different companies right now in terms of looking at what is the renewable natural gas potential there in terms of thinking about inclusion or looking at that opportunity. And then also creating the digestate from there to look at what's the nutrient value from a fertilizer perspective. We see that actually area continuing to grow with the Natural Gas Innovation Act. Right, that we've seen here last year that was passed by the legislature and just conversations we're having with different companies in that area. And then as we continue to look at low carbon fuel standards and how Minnesota companies may participate in those programs as well. And then the other area that we're very interested in is looking at community type digesters. So how do we look at smaller dairy farms and egg processing facilities and different feedstocks? And where is there some critical mass to really advance that opportunity for de-risking that investment into anaerobic digestion.
Representative Lipper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Schleck, could you say that you said there are five different feedstocks that you're testing? Could you just name what those are?
Mr. Schlesch.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lipper, we've been looking at egg processing waste. Overall, we've been looking at some poultry litter into that area, and I could get back to you on some of the other areas that we've been testing in that space. I'll be happy to do so. I'm checking with my technical team.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. You guys have got a really broad reach across Minnesota. I have a question on the mobile meat processing. Central Lake College up in our area has just begun development of a curriculum that would focus on training in that area. I guess, are you aware of that? And is there going to be any, cross-pollination? Because there's some training aspects there that may be able to benefit from the type of people you're going to have on staff.
Mr. Slush.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, we are aware of the work at Central Lakes College as well as the College of Mohmer as well in the curriculum that they're looking to include. It was a requirement in the proposals that the awardee of the mobile meat slaughter unit would work with the 2 year campus. So that was a requirement in terms of proposing what that would look like and ensuring there was a collaboration piece there. Now having a meat scientist on staff or 2 meat scientists on staff, we will definitely be increasing our reach in terms of looking at how do we coordinate and advance those opportunities in the local and regional processing and meat science sector. So definitely something we haven't been able to do very well since 2017 when our meat scientists left us. And now that we have gained that capacity back, we are looking forward to collaborating on a much more intensive basis on those programs.
Representative Lewick?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. We're definitely making progress in that area. Thank you.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shannon, good to see you again. And just a question, we have some extra time on the Hutchinson Road project. We've heard about this now for the last couple of years. It sounds good, it sounds exciting. It is a use for soybean oil. But you know what's next? Did it work out well? Have other cities and county highway departments picked up on this? Or how do you expand that now to make it go more commercialized statewide or nationwide?
Mr. Sletch?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, good to see you as well again. That is a great question in terms of, right, how do we advance this to the next level? We've done the data, we've done the analysis, right? We've been promoting this product as a great opportunity. Working with the founder, with the Minnesota Soybean Research Promotion Council. And we've been talking about that internally in terms of how do we further get this information out to decision makers and advancing it. One of the areas that we're talking about next is just bringing together the key stakeholders in this space. So think about the regional development commissions, for example, and others that would have an appetite here. To try to move forward and advancing this and showing the opportunities overall. I think there's some other areas that we need to look at as well. It's definitely something that that the information is out there and that people can find it, but it looks like I would say we need to do more outreach and just find those right decision makers.
Representative Anderson?
No.
I will also open up the floor to questions for the other testifiers. I believe Commissioner Thompson is still here and staff from the Board of Animal Health. Members, if you still have questions, I can open up time for that too. We are done with our items for the agenda today. Before we adjourn, Chair Sunny asked me to remind everyone to test their audio before committee. Any questions before I adjourned? All right, sounds good. Well, thank you everyone. It was good to see you all. With that, the next meeting is Monday, February 7th. This meeting is adjourned.